This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL Urbana. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. On the program today, how conspiracy theories shape mainstream beliefs and political debate. Historian Robert Allen Goldberg is our guest this afternoon. He says conspiracy thinking has played a significant role in American life and politics since the Republic's beginnings. Robert Goldberg is the author of Enemies Within: The Culture of Conspiracy in Modern America. His book focuses on recent conspiracies of the last half century, including the Communist Fifth Column, the theory of the rise of the Antichrist, the assassination of President Kennedy, the alleged plot against Black America, and the purported UFO incident at Roswell, New Mexico. Goldberg says the scenarios of these conspiracies entwine and are mutually reinforcing. He says, quoting here, "Those who believe wage a struggle not simply for symbolic gain. This is a contest for authority and legitimacy." Listeners, I welcome your questions and comments. You're invited to join us with a telephone call. Here are the numbers. In Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call us toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Robert Goldberg is a professor of history at the University of Utah. In addition to Enemies Within: The Culture of Conspiracy in Modern America, Goldberg is the author of four other books, including Grassroots Resistance, Social Movements in the 20th Century America, and a book on Barry Goldwater. Professor Goldberg's latest book, Enemies Within, is published by Yale University Press. Again, the phone number is 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Professor Goldberg, good afternoon. Welcome. Thanks for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you very much, Celeste. It's a pleasure to be with you.
When we think conspiracy thinking, we think the assassination of President Kennedy leaps to mind right away. Roswell leaps to mind. The Trilateral Commission, the New World Order. But it's interesting to think that conspiracies go back to our founding, before our founding. Maybe before we get to the focus of your book, you'd talk with us a little bit about the conspiracies popular in the American colonies.
Well, we can even go back before the American colonies, because we have to understand that American conspiracy thinking is not a unique trait to our republic. The ideas of Catholic plots or Jewish plots in Europe for centuries plagued the people of the countries of Europe, and frighten them into a variety of measures, whether repressive or not, that color their history.
Is there an American flavor of conspiracy, though?
I think there is, Celeste, and what I'm tuned to is two things. First of all, the idea that Americans have when they came to this country, and I think still cultivate, is a sense of mission within history. That is, Americans were not simply put on the world stage because of their resources, but rather because of a divine hand, that God pushed Americans to be greater than their smallest intentions, that we created this republic and we still continue to live this land because God has a special destiny for us. And in the 19th century, we heard the expression manifest destiny, the idea that we had a divine responsibility to conquer this continent from sea to shining sea for God. So we have this idea that we're doing God's work, and it's an idea that I think continues into the 20th century, into the 21st century. I don't think you can understand America's wars in the 20th century without understanding this idea of a sense of mission and power to spread democracy, to spread freedom, and to spread God's word. So we have this sense of mission. And any time someone is working for God's will or trying to do civilization's work, it's going to arouse the enemies of the divine plan. It's going to arouse Satan and Satan's minion, or to quote the president, the current evildoers and the current axis of power. So we have that going on. But add to that American diversity, our strength as an amalgam of people. Because what we find is that America's diversity creates an idea of suspicion. That is, diversity is a curse because the enemies are within our gates. People subject to other lords, other doctrines who are disloyal and dangerous, people who are, to quote my book, the enemies within.
I'm beginning to see why conspiracies can become addictive.
No Well, they certainly seem to be addictive to the American people, and it's been that case, as you mentioned, from the Republic all the way to the present.
Yeah. Well, let's go back to the founding of the Republic and before, you know, again, to go back to that first question. Maybe you would give us an idea of the conspiracies that were floating around that were popular.
Oh, sure.
Back at the before we became the United States.
Well, before we became the United States, and let's go back to the period before 1776 at least, and if you look at the writings of American colonists, men and women, you see a series of contestants, if you will, put in the plotter's role. Native Americans were seen as conspiring with Satan, or at least conspiring with one another to destroy the English colonies. Salem witches in the 1690s in Massachusetts. Catholics long wanting to take this Protestant haven and make it part of the Pope's dominion. Slaves were another group who certainly did plot, but were seen as plotting far more than they ever did. And then when we get to 1776, Americans believe that there was a British conspiracy, a British plot to destroy liberty. And you only need to read the second paragraph of the Declaration of Independence to see that the idea of conspiracy against American ideals, values, and beliefs, is enshrined in our holy documents.
Mm. It was interesting to read in the early portion of the book that King George was believed to be, by some, to be the Antichrist, and George, meantime, back in England, was thinking he was the victim of a conspiracy.
Exactly. And, you know, it's interesting to look today when we talk about September 11th and realizing that there was actually a conspiracy in regard to September 11th. But looking at the Arab press, whether in Saudi Arabia or in Egypt, which talks constantly of a conspiracy as well against the Arab peoples, whether by the United States or in league with the nation of Israel.
Hmm. Also, early in the book, you note that surveys show that more than three-quarters of us have concluded that President Kennedy was the victim of a conspiracy, and that more of us are certain that extraterrestrials have visited Earth and believe that feminist is a compliment. But so we're all in this.
Well, that's such an important point, because usually when you talk about these kind of issues, it's, well, we're talking about the fringe, and we're talking about deviants, or we think of the Mel Gibson character in the movie Conspiracy Theory, this person who is quite neurotic, quite out of it, who believes in all of these dark forces seeking to plague his life. But my point is that we are looking at a mainstream phenomenon, that large numbers of folks, between 75 and 80%, believe that John Kennedy was killed by more than one assassin. The 60% of the black community believing that guns and drugs were purposely flooded into their communities in order to destroy black life. And we're talking about a large number of people who entertain these kind of doubts about authority, doubts about how history works.
Mm. But yet, when we think conspiracy and we think conspiracy theorists, we generally think kooks.
Well, there's a long tradition to that belief, at least going back into the 1950s and 1960s, which painted conspiracy theorists as deviants. That is, people, men and women, who had personal problems, and what they were doing was venting their personal problems into the public arena through conspiracy thinking. But when you have, again, these ideas of large numbers of people believing, that kind of personal psychosis doesn't work. When I was looking at my book and when I was working at the research and interviewing these conspiracy theorists, what intrigued me about them was not their deviance, but rather their business skills. Mm. Because remember, these people's bread and butter is the ability to sell videos and tapes and books. Their survival is based upon the idea that they are vitally tuned to what sells. So what was key to me was their business skills, their rhetorical strategies, and things like that.
Yeah. Well, in the book, there's an amazing fact. In 1999, the International UFO Museum and Research Center in Roswell, New Mexico, saw its 500,000th visitor. So here we have clearly a conspiracy theory as economic opportunity.
And the Hollywood knows these kind of things are big business. I'm thinking of the cable channels, whether A&E or the Discovery Channel, or even the Travel Channel, which has features on Roswell or on the general theme of UFO visitation. Hollywood knows this works, and Hollywood knows that this commands a large market share.
Hmm. Well, how did Roswell become Roswell?
That's a very good question. Something happened. That's the best way to put it. Something happened in the desert in Roswell, New Mexico, in July of 1947. What exactly occurred is to this day unclear, because in a sense there is not a shred of physical evidence that anything occurred, other than a newspaper article that a UFO, a flying saucer, as they were called in those days, had been recovered in the desert beyond Roswell. What was quickly dismissed as a weather balloon. Okay, the story then basically died until about 30 years later, when several researchers began to interview people who said they saw something, they touched something, they heard something, they carried something, which smacked to them of something extraterrestrial. And then it became a gold rush to Roswell as research team after research team, television team after television team, decided to mine the gold that was Roswell.
Mm. Well, I can remember a few years ago watching the movie Independence Day.
Yes.
Which took us to Area 51.
Blockbuster.
Yeah.
Nonetheless, you know what was key to me about that movie?
What?
The key to me was we go into Area 51, which again is now part of the lexicon of American, the American language. We go into Area 51, and we have a brief discussion of the aliens that are kind of on ice or floating in oil in there. And the audience needed very, very little explanation. And I think it's the Judd Hirsch character who says something to the effect, what are you giving me? We all know it was Roswell. We all know that those guys landed in Roswell. You guys covered it up. That was it, three or four or five sentences. The movie worked because it was based upon the foreknowledge of the audience. And that was absolutely key to me, which was you don't need much explanation. We're all tuned to what you have to say. And on some level, it's believable.
Yeah, well, that's what I'm getting to here, because I remember that what I remember about that film was that there was a lot of humor in it, a lot of tongue-in-cheek kind of things to it. And there were points where, you know, we're talking about alien invasion and the audience is rolling on the floor laughing. But yet, you know, there are a lot of believers out there. So, you know, here's the next question. Let's talk about what makes a conspiracy theory believable.
I think there are several things that make conspiracy thinking believable. One is the comfort that conspiracy thinking gives. That is, conspiracy thinking orders the random. It finds meaning in events. It finds purpose. I think it also clarifies ambiguity. Conspiracy thinking gives hope. It provides unity. That is, a group of people can believe. I think particularly important is the power of conspiracy thinking to enfranchise its believers. That is, to give them the answer, to provide the clue to the secret, which other people don't seem to have. And that enfranchisement, that is, that giving them a sense of power, is crucial to understanding why they're believable.
Mm.
I want to add to that. Key is also who presents the message. If the message is presented by a minister, if the message is presented by a statesman, if the message is presented by somebody who has credibility, that enhances the message. If the message is seen repeatedly, and I'm thinking of the power of the Internet at this point, If the message is replicated over and over and over again, that will give it credibility. When you link one message to another, John Kennedy was killed because he was going to reveal the existence of UFO contact with the federal government. What you do there is not only bring in the believers of the Kennedy assassination, but you also bring in the UFO community as well.
Very interesting. Historian Robert Allen Goldberg is our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. He's the author of Enemies Within, The Culture of Conspiracy in Modern America. Listeners, you're invited to join us with your questions and comments this afternoon in Champaign-Urbana, the number 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. We have a couple of listeners waiting to talk with us. Let's go first to our first caller this afternoon, Line 1, Champaign County. Good afternoon.
Hello.
Hi.
I wanted to raise the point that there have been conspiracies now, and I think that some of them have never been fully investigated, and some of them, I think of, well, who would have thought that Reagan really did sell arms to Iran? You know, it was the major antagonist of that time to fund the Contras. I mean, things like that, which are now, you know, generally accepted, maybe not taught that much or known that much about. There's a similar instance where the Clark Amendment prohibited selling and arming UNITA in Angola, and that was also illicitly and conspiratorially finessed. I personally think that, going back to the Iran thing, that there was an October surprise. Gary Sick, I guess his name is, was a Carter hand, and he believes it. He's written a full-length book of it, but it doesn't get much, you know, play. So I think that, you know, there certainly are a lot of debunking is necessary, but I think the fact that there are conspiracies that did happen that don't get acknowledged, and they often, in, you know, leading up to the time when everybody accepted that arms sales did happen to Iran, they were dismissed with the usual thing. Well, that's just some kind of mad conspiratorial thinking. Reagan couldn't possibly really be sending, you know, arms to Iran, that sort of thing. Do you have any response to that?
I do. First of all, I think your point is very well taken. Conspiracies clearly exist, not only in American history, but world history. Abraham Lincoln was killed as the result of a conspiracy. The weathermen were planting bombs at the end of the 1960s and early 1970s in a conspiracy. September 11th was definitely the work of a conspiracy of at least 19 men and many, many more as well. So conspiracies do happen. Where we want to draw the line, where it is important to draw the line, is when we make conspiracy the moving force of history, the moving force of events, where we deny that randomness doesn't occur, where we deny the idea of chance or institutional process or the workings of miscalculation. When we lay everything to conspiracy thinking and the power of conspirators, that's when I think we go awry.
All the examples you gave there were non-governmental actions, and the examples I gave were all, you know, arguable. I think the Iran-Contra is the most accepted by, you know, generally, but still.
Well, I think we could also talk about CIA actions in the 1950s in a variety of places, whether Nicaragua or Iran. And I think I can add to that, and I can talk about some of the things that occurred in regard to the FBI's counterintelligence program of the 1960s. Mm. So I'm not denying that those things occur. What bothers me is a cult of secrecy that the federal government seems to believe in that puts a damper on information that keeps us from knowing more than we can know. And, you know, I constantly refer to World War II in regard to this, when we were all told that we were in on the secret, and that was loose-lipped six ships, the posters said, because Americans knew what was going on. They were all on the same team. I think Americans have developed, because of federal actions, a distance from their own government, and their suspicions have increased about their government as a result.
Yeah. It's important that you point out that the culture of secrecy then leaves this kind of, you know, limbo where people, where there is no good explanation for something.
Exactly. And, you know, I'm thinking of Clinton's actions in regard to the Kennedy assassination. He created a assassination review board to get all of the information out as much as possible, re-interview people, find out why this material was classified. And much of the conspiracy thinking that comes out of the 1960s in regard to the Kennedy assassination related to the idea that this stuff was covered up, this stuff was hidden, this stuff was mysteriously lost for a reason. And I think shedding light on these issues, shedding light on these materials, whether they're about UFOs or Kennedy assassins, I think that's a very positive thing. Whether it will dampen conspiracy thinking is another idea, because I remember reading one conspiracist who was talking about the review board's work, and he said, well, they've released a lot of stuff, but we also know that there are hidden file cabinets which we'll never see. So it becomes a tautology in regard to figuring out what to do and what not to do.
Well, that's an interesting one that you bring up, because I actually share the majority opinion of the population that it couldn't possibly have been one actor alone. So,
well, you have a lot of support for that.
I think it was probably the mafia, though, but and maybe some elements, but I don't know.
The mafia certainly has been listed among the co-conspirators in that that event.
Right, but I think it's important not to mix up, you know, some really demonstrable, you know, some that you pointed out, and then Iran-Contra is the big one, but, you know, that might have not even happened, because, you know, it wasn't enough to disqualify the actors who were involved in that one to
mm-hmm.
keep them out of the current Bush administration.
Mm-hmm.
And they're also eroding our Freedom of Information Act privileges, I understand. So,
well, and the Freedom of Information Act is to quote Wyatt Earp, the law is a funny thing. I would say the Freedom of Information Act is a funny thing. There are a variety of things that it reveals and a variety of things that it still closes down. And I think we have the image that the Freedom of Information Act has become this wealth of information for us, but there are ways about it and around it.
I want to thank the listener for his call this afternoon. We're going to go on to another listener now online, to a caller in Champaign. Hi.
Hi. I think that the relatively powerless in our society use conspiracy theories to explain things that they perhaps can't understand or aren't given the proper information to understand, and I think that's a fault in both our educational and mainstream media systems. I think that the relatively powerful use conspiracy theories in a much more cynical way and perhaps less sincere way in order to scare the quote-unquote common people into going along with wars and other policies. I think that the increasingly the relatively powerful also use the charge of conspiracy theorizing to discredit or debunk those who have realistic suspicions about what the government is doing and why it's doing it. And I think in the specific example of the Middle East, I think that what we've seen is a very complicated phenomenon in which you have a conspiracy expert like Daniel Pipes, who argues that the that Arab cultures or Muslim cultures are rife with conspiracy theorizing on the one hand, but on the other hand, he argues that such thinking foments conspiracies, and therefore he becomes a kind of conspiracy theorist mm-hmm. and a kind of mainstream conspiracy theorist in itself by arguing that we are indeed threatened by Muslim cultures, mm-hmm. not only without, but from within, as he's argued. He argues that Muslim citizens of this country are a kind of fifth column, or a kind of incipient fifth column. Could you comment on these, please?
Well, I would love to. First of all, I find your comments quite knowledgeable, and my book is very much written along the lines you're arguing. That is, people without power or have little sense of power or distance from power are very susceptible to believing in conspiratorial ideas. And also, I've argued through this book and through American history the use of conspiracy theory as a manipulating factor by elites, whether they are by government elites or by media elites, whether it's to seize power, take power, hold power, or just to simply make some money. And I think those are incredibly important points. I have similar problems with Professor Pipe's books, whether it's his books specifically about the Middle East or his books about conspiracy thinking,
mm-hmm.
that he is able to create these ideas about conspiracy thinking. But what he does, and he's intuitive in very, very, very many ways, but what he does is he diminishes the argument by giving us psychological theories and psychological excuses to understand what's happening. And in that, he dismisses the power and the importance of conspiracy thinking by making it simply the product of people who are simply not right in their own societies, whether here or there.
But doesn't he exaggerate the role of conspiracies in history? I mean, he's basically arguing in his book Conspiracy that the way to really understand Hitler and Stalin and people
right.
like that, as well as the modern Middle East, is to understand fundamentally that these were conspiracy theorists, that Hitler was a conspiracy theorist, and he was motivated primarily by this interpretation of the world. So whether or not Hitler used conspiracies in a cynical way or in a sincere way, it doesn't explain how he was able to do what he did.
Well,
let me institutional sense.
On that. And first of all, I thought that Pipe's arguments about the Soviet Union and Stalin and Hitler and Nazi Germany and conspiracy theories, I thought those were interesting parts of the book. What was important to me was to understand less that Hitler was a conspiracy theorist and that he was manipulating with conspiracy theory, but rather why the mass of people were at least amenable or at least tolerated this kind of conspiracy thinking. So what was important to me, again, was why people believe these things. What did this give them for their lives? Why was it important for them to understand the world in those conspiratorial ways? And I think that's where that book is amiss.
But don't you think that there's a kind of elitist conspiracy, a kind of complicated sort of second-order conspiracy theorizing going on now? I mean, in the current rhetoric about the war, the argument is being made implicitly or explicitly that Saddam Hussein is conspiring against us.
Well, I think that's a very important point as well, and it's not simply Saddam Hussein. If you recall the president's expression, it's an axis of evil.
Right.
So it's not simply Saddam, but it's also the North Koreans. And then we hear expressions about shadow governments, and we hear this evildoer stuff. And you realize that the United States government has played the conspiracy card over and over again, whether in the 1950s about communists, in the 1960s about black radicals, in the 1980s about right-wingers. You have this power. And I think what the government is basically telling us is Americans are very interested in this. Americans believe this stuff, and this stuff works. And if we want to get our policies enacted, we're going to play to what has meaning to them. Maybe the expressions spreading democracy, freedom, and liberty aren't as powerful as they used to be.
Can I say one more thing?
Sure.
One more thing, sure.
I mean, this may be somewhere you don't want to go, but as someone with an obviously Jewish last name, and I am also, I've kept a pretty close eye on sort of Jewish institutional culture in regard to commonly held views about the Middle East, such as I've referred to. And I see these views really taking over, I mean, being very, very much the conventional wisdom about how we are supposed to think about Arab countries and Muslim countries, that they are conspiratorial countries, and therefore we cannot trust them. And I'm wondering if you're willing to comment on how you feel about specifically Jewish culture in this country, and I mean Jewish sort of institutional culture.
Let me say a few things. I think to understand Jewish mentality at the end of the 20th century, we have to put an emphasis on the power of the Holocaust over Jews and their beliefs about people around them. And I think that the Holocaust absolutely shadows and fixes how American Jews and Israeli Jews understand the world around them. I think of Menachem Begin's constant references to Hitler and to Arafat as Hitler, to Saddam Hussein as Hitler, and a variety of other enemies as Hitler. So I put that as one piece that I want to mention. And the second piece I want to mention is Israelis and American Jews have a sense of the power relations in the Middle East in a way that they looked in 1953 or 1954. And there's no sense of the change in the balance of power. And as a result of that, it is very easy to conceptualize yourself as a victim, not only of history, but of your neighbors.
I want to thank the listener for his call this afternoon. I've got a number of other listeners waiting to talk with us this afternoon, so we're going to go on to a caller on the toll-free line, a caller in Eureka. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. A very interesting conversation. I think the last caller sort of touched on what I was going to say when he was talking about conspiracy theories maybe being part of the dispossessed and the left out in society to explain things. My question is, I wonder if you had followed such persons as Hal Lindsey or John Hagee, who would be in the same philosophical realm as, say, Jerry Falwell or Pat Robertson in terms of eschatological, the idea of last things, Bible prophecy, and the kind of scheme they use. And I know if I just listen to them every once in a while, they always seem to be coming up with every any kind of conspiracy theories. Lindsey and Hagee are on the Trinity Broadcasting Network, which, let's see, Jan and Paul Crouch are the founders, and they're always seeming to spout these conspiracy arguments in the framework of Bible prophecy, last things, the end times. Would you have any comment on that?
Yes. One of my chapters in this book is on the Antichrist and the coming end of the world and how conspiracy thinking has permeated the religious mainstream, particularly in regard to evangelicals and fundamentalists.
Mm-hmm.
And what I maintain there, looking at in detail at Hal Lindsey's book, but also looking at Pat Robertson's book, The New World Order, it's the idea that Satan and his offspring, the Antichrist, are using the United Nations, the Trilateral Commission, mm-hmm. the Council on Foreign Relations, and other kinds of organizational mechanisms to bring to power the Antichrist and to trigger the last days. The rapture then becomes an escape hatch to escape the conspiracy, while those people who are not true believers, those people who have not found Jesus, will have to face the conspiracy and in the final days probably be destroyed.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. Next, we go to a listener in Chicago on line one.
On a note about conspiracy at another level, we have the World Trade programs in which secrecy prevailed and led to the situation that we saw in Seattle and other parts of the world, where less than transparency certainly was the order of the day, where countries and people did not know what was going to be happening relative to their economy and environment and so on. So that's another example of conspiracy being held up right in front of us today, let alone the conspiracy in corporate practices. And we could go on the line, but we have examples of conspiracy, like going back to Napoleon, when suddenly the funds were withdrawn from him, and he wondered who decided to no longer support him. And then you have the Holocaust in China, and we can go on and on, where at the time of FDR, being president, he sought information about the oncoming progress and the encroachment on the Chinese of Mao Zedong and the subordination of Chiang Kai-shek, and he had to turn to missionaries for information because we at that time didn't have all those diplomatic places in place for information. And today, electronic input as we have around the world was still short on those diplomatic and personal relationships that seem to develop issues that are, lacking in personal contact and relationship. And the closer we can get, such as you're having your program today, the better we will be in alleviating any further notions of conspiracy.
Professor Goldberg?
I think the listener has to be really tuned to the idea that events that occur in history, and he went through a variety of events from the present all the way to the past, suggest the workings of hidden groups that are diabolical and purposeful, and they have the power to control nations, they have the power to trigger depression. depressions or inflationary spirals that they have the power to assassinate at will. And I want to get off that idea in regard to conspiracy thinking, because we have to understand that history is the workings of human beings. And human beings are given to chance, they're given to coincidence, institutions work in a variety of ways, and not everything is a conspiracy, not all history is a conspiracy, and we have to be very specific in regard to how we understand the happenings and the events of the world.
Hmm. Are there periods of time when we're more susceptible?
Well, I talk about the 1990s, particularly as being a hothouse of conspiracy thinking, when so many things seemed to come together. Whether it's the idea that the world was going to end in the year 2000, or the Roswell's 50th anniversary was in 1997, or Louis Farrakhan had reached power and was pushing for a march on Washington. Or the anniversary of the Kennedy assassination, or the appearance of Oliver Stone's JFK movie, all of these seemed to come together, and then we had a variety of things occurring in the White House which seemed to demonstrate that conspiracy was the order of the nation every day. Most conspiracy people who look at conspiracy thinking look at times of stress, whether it's economic hardship or dizzying inflation or periods of war, as times when conspiracy thinking seems to have its best audience.
Hmm. I want to go back to talk. We don't have a whole lot of time here, but I want to go back in history to the stage being set for the Red Scare of the post-war years.
Mm-hmm.
That was really interesting to me, that President Roosevelt and J. Edgar Hoover were meeting in the late 30s to talk about domestic subversion. And then, you know, I'm wondering, to what extent did that set the stage?
Well, I think it did set the stage. Let's first note, there were communists who were in the federal government in the 1930s and 1940s. Interestingly enough, they were primarily in the Department of Agriculture and focused in the resettlement administration of the New Deal. So not in positions of power that to affect defense or necessarily the workings of nations. But what was crucial to my mind in regard to those meetings between Franklin Roosevelt and J. Edgar Hoover was, if you will, and I'll use this expression, the unleashing of J. Edgar Hoover.
Mm.
Because the spreading of the idea that communists have infiltrated the United States, and not just the federal government. They've infiltrated the schools. They've infiltrated the universities. They're in the libraries. They're in the churches. They're everywhere. They're under the beds. This is a powerful argument to make when you're seeking higher appropriations for your organization, when you need more agents, when you are building a power base. And I think it's important to realize that administrative and bureaucratic imperative was a very powerful force propelling the Red Scare of the 1940s and 1950s. In addition to that, the Republican Party was simply out of power since 1932, and they needed an issue. And in the Red Scare, they found an issue. And let me note on top of that, the Democrats realized the power of the issue and were not going to be slackers on that issue. And it's Harry Truman and his administration that is pushing for review boards and loyalty boards in order to test the loyalty of federal employees, which then gives power in a cycle, gives power to the critics saying, I told you so, even the federal government is doing something about it. Even if the federal government doesn't find anybody, that's proof of something else as well.
Gee, it sort of sounds like today.
Well, you know, I got to tell you, Celeste, I'm struck, whether it's economically, politically, or what have you, with the parallels between this period of time and the 1950s. I have a sense today what it was like to live in the 1950s by living through the situation today in regard to the war on terrorism and the fear of dissent at this point.
Mm. Well, there's been some pressure here in Champaign County on candidates in local races to sign a loyalty oath.
Well, you know, this is the real demon of conspiracy thinking, if you will, because what conspiracy thinking does is it says you are disloyal, you are untrustworthy, you are unpatriotic, you are un-American. And what that does is demonizes. And when you demonize your opponent, there's no room for compromise, there's no room for moderation, there's no room for negotiation. And that, to me, those things are inherent in the health of a republic, the ability to compromise, the ability to conciliate, the ability to negotiate. And when you lose that, you threaten the vital basis of the republic.
In the book, on the in the chapter that you focus a lot of attention on Louis Farrakhan, you note that conspiracies breed activism and social movement mobilization. Are conspiracy theories essential to activism?
I don't think they're essential, but they certainly work powerfully to mobilize groups of people. Because what you do is you say, we are in a situation that is not good for us, whether it's economically not good for us or politically not good for us. We are hurting and we are in pain. And the question is, why are we in this situation? Why have these events occurred? And if you're able to point a finger at an individual or a group, you create the mechanism for mobilization. You pinpoint the enemy, you target the enemy, and you also then say, we can remove the enemy. In other words, you provide hope, you provide optimism in regard to mobilization. That is going to get people stirred up, that is going to get people to contribute to the cause, and that is going to get people to join the movement.
Hmm. How is this decade shaping up?
Well, you know, it's interesting to me because we have this new birth of patriotism in America,
mm-hmm.
and a rally around the flag because of the tragedy of 9/11. But at the same time, Celeste, what absolutely intrigues me is how the tragedy of 9/11 has been molded to fit the old conspiracy theories. That is, it was the Jews who engineered the World Trade Center disaster. Or it was the CIA that did it, working for the New World Order. Or it was, as Representative McKinney of Georgia has indicated, George Bush knew all about it, and he didn't say anything because he wanted his friends in business to make a fortune on the war in Afghanistan. Now, that reminded me of Oliver Stone's JFK movie. And then there are some people who talked about seeing in the smoke of the World Trade Center the face of Satan. Another end-time mm-hmm. scenario. What intrigues me is the power to mold this event to fit the old conspiracy theories and tells me that conspiracy thinking is alive and well. And when the president then talks about evildoers, he creates black and white situations, talks about an axis of evil, we're in the same cycle that we've been in the past.
Mm-hmm.
And one final point about this. Hollywood keeps pumping out the conspiracy movies. They are feeding us a diet of conspiracy movies. They entertain us with conspiracism. And this leaves us susceptible to believing in conspiracies.
Yeah. So even though, you know, going back to that movie Independence Day, when we were all highly entertained and knew it was just make-believe, nonetheless, it has an impact on
When we watched the movie, Mel Gibson movie, Conspiracy Theory, with Julia Roberts, we were thinking, what a nut this is. This is not anybody we invite home for dinner. Look how neurotic he is. Look how his eyes shift. Look at all the locks on his doors. But you know something? We withheld judgment. We withheld judgment because, well, part of it was Mel Gibson and his friend Julia Roberts. But we withheld judgment because maybe there's some truth in the conspiracy theory. And if you recall how that movie ended, yes, Virginia, there was a conspiracy involved.
Mm. Truth is out there.
The truth is out there. Very good, Celeste.
You know, that show, too, an amazing show. That drew on everything, didn't it?
Oh, it worked so well. First, again, ran through the 1990s, which was our conspiracy decade par excellence for the last 30 or 40 years. And it touched UFOs, it touched the ideas of the New World Order, it touched the religiosity of belief in the Antichrist and Satan. It hit every button. And on top of that, wait for the X-File movies, because the way the last episode ended, the truth is out there, but we really still haven't gotten a grasp on the conspirators.
Mm. But it's not looking good.
It's not looking good, no.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us this afternoon.
It's Nevertheless, I had a wonderful time. Thank you very much.
Historian Robert Allen Goldberg has been our guest this afternoon in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. His book, Enemies Within the Culture of Conspiracy in Modern America, is published by Yale University Press.